Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Barbara Roberts, a cardiologist and veteran pro-choice activist, who explains why she believes new abortion laws passed in Republican-controlled states disproportionately impact women of color. Mel Goodman, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and former CIA analyst, who questions the credibility of U.S. intelligence warnings about an imminent Iranian attack against U.S. forces that could be used to draw the nation into a costly new war. And Kathy Kunkel of the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, who talks about why grassroots and environmental groups in Puerto Rico oppose a plan to privatize the island's publicly owned electric utility company. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the days after the launch of the recent siege of Libya's capital city, Tripoli, President Donald Trump called rebel commander General Khalifa Haftar, head of the so-called Libyan National Army, signaling a dramatic shift in U.S. foreign policy. Up to that point, the U.S. had recognized Libya's United Nations-backed government of national accord and called for a ceasefire in Tripoli. The North African nation has been plagued by violence since the ouster and killing of longtime strongman Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. At the urging of key Haftar allies Saudi Arabia and Egypt, Trump called the militia commander and praised his significant role in fighting terrorism and securing Libya's oil resources. The two men also reportedly discussed a shared vision for Libya's transition to a stable democratic political system. But Amnesty International, which has criticized Haftar's offensive against Tripoli, called on the International Criminal Court to expand its investigations into possible war crimes by all sides in Libya's conflict. Thus far, over 400 people have been killed during the fighting, and 60,000 have been forced to flee their homes. In early May, Libya's Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj, who leads the UN-recognized government, embarked on a well-publicized trip to Europe, including meetings with French President Emmanuel Macron, who previously had backed General Haftar. Sarraj sought to exclude Haftar from future political talks. However, his plea was rejected by key leaders in Germany, France, and Britain, who want to return to the Abu Dhabi Agreement, which calls for a national presidential and legislative election by the end of this year. Amid rising violence in the Amazon rainforest, indigenous groups mobilized in Brasilia, Brazil's capital, to protest the destructive policies of extreme right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro, who rejects the science of climate change. Hundreds of indigenous activists occupied downtown streets and marched on the Ministry of Justice, seeking land rights protections and improved public services. Indigenous leaders are demanding the restoration of the National Foundation of the Indigenous, which was shut down in the early days of the Bolsonaro administration. A member of the Xucuru people told Al Jazeera News, "They are taking our medicine, our health coverage, our health workers." 8 former environmental ministers have condemned Bolsonaro for systematically destroying Brazil's environmental protection policies. In rural Brazil, police often act as mercenaries for landowners and provide security for private construction and mining projects. Since the election of Bolsonaro last year, indigenous groups have documented an increase in the number of land grabs and violent attacks, while deforestation is at a 10-year high. Kamala Harris became the first 2020 presidential candidate to call for a complete repeal of President Trump's tax cuts, which largely benefit the rich and big corporations. Harris, a U.S. senator from California, wants to redirect tax cut funds to her LIFT Act, a lower and middle-class tax credit for families making up to $100,000 per year. Democratic primary voters expect candidates to repeal the Trump tax cuts and provide alternative ideas on what to do with the proceeds, reports the American Prospect. Elizabeth Warren has proposed a new wealth tax on the super rich and a minimum tax on corporations. Other candidates also have big ideas. Bernie Sanders advocates the adoption of Medicare for all. Cory Booker has proposed baby bonds for each new child. And Amy Klobuchar favors allocating $1 trillion for infrastructure. Progressives often complain that Democratic leaders have put the party in a fiscal straitjacket by insisting on pay-as-you-go rules while Trump Republicans offer limitless tax cuts. Progressive economist Stephanie Kelton observed that progressive tax reform could channel help directly to the poor, the struggling, and people with no health care. In order for Democrats to gain voter support, they must be specific about where they would recommit funds recovered from the Trump tax cuts. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After the U.S. Senate confirmed Judge Brett Kavanaugh, Donald Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court last year, anti-abortion activists and their allies in state legislatures across the country doubled their efforts to pass more aggressive restrictions on access to abortion. Their thinking was that with Kavanaugh replacing Justice Anthony Kennedy, they would now have the fifth vote needed to uphold new limits on abortion or even overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade decision, which legalized abortion in 1973. On May 15th, Alabama's legislature passed, and Republican Governor Kay Ivey signed into law a bill that bans all abortions outright, with no exceptions for rape or incest. The only exemption permitted in the legislation is to avoid a serious health risk to the unborn child's mother. Seven other states, Georgia, Kentucky, Mississippi, Missouri, Ohio, Arkansas, and Utah, have all passed new abortion restrictions, with the aim of challenging a woman's right to have a legal abortion before the Supreme Court. Dr. Barbara Hudson Roberts, Rhode Island's first female adult cardiologist, became active in the pro-choice movement before the Roe v. Wade decision. She helped found the Women's National Abortion Action Coalition and was the keynote speaker at the first national pro-choice demonstration in Washington, D.C. in November 1971. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Roberts, who explains why she believes that new abortion restrictions imposed by state governments would disproportionately impact women of color and those who are economically disadvantaged.
You know, I was a medical student and a young house officer in the late 60s and early 70s before abortion was legalized. And what I saw in those days really radicalized me. I saw women who had to put themselves in the hands of back alley butchers come into the emergency room with septic shock, with perforated wombs, with their bowels hanging out of their vaginas because they were desperate to end pregnancies and their own physicians were prevented by law from doing so. And I became active when I was a resident at Yale New Haven Hospital.
Well, Barbara, I did want to find out a bit about your views on what we see going on in states across the country. Alabama, Georgia, Missouri, Texas, and Ohio are among the states imposing restrictions. Some would say illegal restrictions on abortion, given the Roe v. Wade decision by the Supreme Court many years ago.
Right. Well, Scott, I think and I hope that what we're seeing by these actions, by these male legislators, and they're almost all male who are introducing it, although the governor, I believe it was of Alabama, who was the woman, signed the bill. What I think we're seeing is the last gasp of a misogynistic, patriarchal society which has oppressed women for millennia. No groups in power give up power without a struggle. But what is very interesting to me, particularly considering Alabama and Georgia, are that laws restricting or outlawing abortion have a greater negative impact on black, minority, and poor women than they do on white women. So perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that two of the three states that have recently essentially banned all abortions were Confederate states, which fought to keep slavery legal in the South. The Civil War was won by the North, and slaves were emancipated, but then across the South, a wave of terror started, led by the Ku Klux Klan, whose aim was to terrorize blacks and prevent them from achieving equal rights. And if we look at the history of lynching in the United States, over 4,000 black Southerners were lynched during the period from the end of the Civil War to just after World War II. 589 of those lynchings occurred in Georgia, and Alabama accounted for 361 of them. Ohio itself had 35 lynchings. So not only are these anti-abortion laws an attack against all women, they preferentially are harmful to black, poor, and minority women. For example, we know that in 1962, nearly 1,600 women were admitted to the Harlem Hospital with incomplete abortions, which is a common complication of illegal abortions. And there was one abortion-related hospital admission for every 42 deliveries at the hospital that year. From 1972 to 1974, the mortality rate due to illegal abortions for non-white women was 12 times that for white women. So the people who are going to be most impacted by these draconian abortion laws are minority and poor women. Even before Roe v. Wade, a wealthy woman could always get an abortion, even if she had to fly out of the country to do it. It was the poor and the minorities who were most affected and died most often.
Do you believe the women's rights movement and groups like Planned Parenthood are fully prepared to take on these anti-abortion groups, which are moving very quickly in these states that have imposed these restrictions on abortion, to bring these cases to the Supreme Court in order to challenge Roe versus Wade to either weaken it or overturn it?
If Roe v. Wade is overturned, I think you will see a mass movement that will make the suffragist movement and the second wave of feminism of the early 70s seem puny by comparison. I really believe that. You know, I think young women can't remember what it was like before Roe v. Wade, but they're the ones who are going to be affected if abortion becomes illegal. And I think you have so many women now who would be so outraged at this blatant taking away of their ability to control their own reproductive lives that I think it could spell the end of the Republican Party. I really believe there will be a mass movement like nothing we have seen before.
That was Dr. Barbara Roberts, a cardiologist and veteran pro-choice activist. She serves on the voluntary faculty at Brown University, where she's an associate clinical professor of medicine. Her forthcoming memoir is titled The Dr. Broad, A Mafia Love Story. For more perspectives on challenges to legal abortion in the U.S., visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The most recent ratcheting up of tensions between the U.S. and Iran began on May 5th, when Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton announced the U.S. was deploying an aircraft carrier strike group and bomber task force to the Persian Gulf in response to U.S. intelligence agencies' warning of threats from Iran or their proxies in both Iraq and Syria. On May 15th, the State Department ordered all non-emergency government employees to leave its embassy in Baghdad, its consulate in Erbil, and advised Americans against traveling to Iraq. However, British Deputy Commander in the Global Coalition Against the Islamic State Group contradicted the U.S. warning of an Iranian attack. Major General Chris Giga told reporters, quote, "There's been no increased threat from Iranian-backed forces in Iraq and Syria." Germany's Foreign Minister Heiko Maas told Trump's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a recent meeting that America's unilateral strategy of increasing pressure against Iran was ill-advised. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, Senior Fellow at the Center for International Policy, Adjunct Professor of International Relations at Johns Hopkins University, and a former CIA Senior Analyst and Division Chief from 1966 to 1990. Here, Goodman questions the credibility of U.S. intelligence that could be used to draw the nation into a costly war with Iran and assesses the muddled objectives of the Trump administration Iran policy.
Well, if you look at the entire body of Trump's actions against Iran from the time he came into the White House in 2017, it seems so long ago, so much has happened. Every action he's taken against Iran is consistent with the idea of preparing a case for war, a war that he claims he really does not want. And it happens against the background of wanting to pull troops out of Syria and then backing off when he ran into resistance, wanting to pull more troops out of Afghanistan and then backing off again when the Pentagon resisted. But Iran seems to be a special fixation, and I think part of it is a fixation with the Obama legacy. So he's targeted the Iran nuclear accord, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But he's also joined with Saudi Arabia and Israel, which is essentially an alliance to put greater pressure on Iran. And there really is no great rationalization for it, but in walking away from the Iran nuclear agreement, which was a very important international agreement in which Secretary of State John Kerry not only got Iran to negotiate away from its nuclear program, but he got Russia to join in with us along with China and key European states. This was a clear step against Iran, and particularly against Iran's moderates who wanted this agreement. And this was one of the things that bothered me most about walking away from the agreement. It meant you really compromised the efforts of the moderates and particularly the Rouhani government to get this agreement in the first place. It wasn't popular in all sections of the Iranian political community. And then you look at the branding of the Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization, the first time the United States has ever gone after a state organization as opposed to a non-state actor, a step that the Pentagon did not want because they argued correctly and prophetically that Iran would just turn around and declare American troops in the Middle East as terrorist organizations, which they've done. If you look at the sanctions he's placed on their economy, particularly on oil, which is about 40% of Iran's gross national product in terms of an economy that is struggling to begin with. And now, without any predicate, at least the Europeans aren't buying into it. They don't see any predicate. He's upped the ante in terms of the carrier task force, which is a fairly significant armada, and sending B-52 bombers into the region, which I think makes no sense at all. And the discussion of 120,000 troops, about the same number of troops, actually, that were used to wage the war against Iraq in 2003. The Europeans do not believe that there's any intelligence that justify these moves. The administration itself has not produced any intelligence that's satisfactory in any way. The Pentagon has refused to declassify any of the photographs they claim that they have, and the few photos that I've seen reference to don't prove anything, that they have these small Iranian boats that may or may not have missiles on them with no evidence whatsoever that they've been delivered to anybody. And, of course, the accusation, and the White House is filled with accusations, is that this was weaponry that was going to go to foreign militias in places that weren't mentioned, but presumably Yemen would have been the recipient, the Houthi movement in Yemen. So it has no rationale. It's not in the context of a policy or a strategy or a plan. It just comes out of thin air, and presumably it'll fade away in a few days, like everything else associated with Donald Trump, and we'll have a new crisis to consider.
Mel, Tom Cotton, Republican senator of Arkansas and Iraq War veteran himself, said recently in an interview he inferred it would be pretty easy to defeat the nation of Iran in a coming war. And he's certainly well known as a war hawk. What do you make about folks making statements like this, talking about how easy a war would be against the nation of Iran?
Well, it's very reminiscent of the so-called cakewalk Iraq was going to be in 2003. That's what Paul Wolfowitz, the deputy at the Defense Department, told us. That's essentially what Dick Cheney said. Cotton is an extremely dangerous individual because he has this complete loyalty toward Donald Trump and everything Donald Trump stands for. So people like Cotton, Lindsey Graham, who has publicly said on many occasions, I'd rather fight that war over there than have to fight it over here. This is the kind of dangerous language that's alienating the United States throughout the international community, not just in Europe, but everywhere throughout the international community.
That was Mel Goodman, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, adjunct professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University, and a former CIA senior analyst and division chief. Find more analysis and commentary on the dangers of the Trump administration's policy toward Iran by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico in September 2017, electricity has finally been restored to most of the island's more than 3 million residents. The antiquated, dysfunctional, and polluting electricity grid collapsed after Maria's hurricane-force winds pummeled generators, power lines, and transformers. Now a new proposal to settle the more than $8 billion in legacy debt of the publicly owned Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, or PREPA, signals profits for bondholders, insurers, and consultants at the expense of Puerto Rico's electrical system and consumers. That's according to research by the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. The debt restructuring agreement was negotiated between PREPA, the Financial Oversight and Management Board for Puerto Rico, a fiscal control board created by Congress to deal with Puerto Rico's debt crisis, a group of bondholders, and one of the insurers of PREPA bonds. Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rossello, and the head of PREPA support the deal, while grassroots and environmental groups oppose it. Kathy Kunkel, an energy researcher with the U.S.-based Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, says efforts to privatize PREPA could hamper the island's conversion to renewable energy and keep it locked into burning fossil fuels, either the dirty imported oil it operated on before the storm, or on a build-out of fracked natural gas. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Kunkel, who describes the process by which this critical decision will be made, and who's supporting and opposing it.
I wouldn't say that it's inevitable. I mean, I guess for a couple of reasons, one of which is, you know, looking historically at Puerto Rico, there was an attempt in the late 90s, I believe, to do something sort of similar in terms of a concession agreement for the water company, which is also a publicly owned utility. So they were going to basically bring in a private operator to run the water utility. And they did sign the contract, and then it ended up being so expensive and rates went up a lot. And then like a few years later, they canceled the contract. So even if they sign a deal for like a concession for the transmission and distribution system, doesn't necessarily mean that it's forever. You know, another piece of it is that I think, you know, these deals that they're trying to put together are fairly financially risky to the investors as well, especially now with this, like, debt restructuring agreement that essentially says that the first priority is paying off the legacy debt. You know, it's going to be more expensive and riskier for new investors to be investing in the electrical system, which, you know, means that they may not get as much interest as they had hoped for. That, you know, it may end up being very expensive to finance private new generation in Puerto Rico. So, you know, all those things make it so that I would not call privatization inevitable.
Kathy Kunkel, who makes the decision about whether PREPA will be privatized? Since Puerto Rico is a commonwealth, some say colony, of the U.S., is it Congress?
No, because Congress in 2016 established this fiscal control board for Puerto Rico, which also like essentially a bankruptcy process in the courts to deal with the Puerto Rican debt issue. And so the debt agreement that has been struck for PREPA has to be approved by the bankruptcy court. And then it also requires some new legislation in Puerto Rico. So effectively, it has to be approved by the Puerto Rican legislature, too.
Are there other groups besides the main union at PREPA that are opposed to privatization?
All the environmental groups in Puerto Rico are against it, you know, in part because of the rate impact and then in part because it also imposes these debt charges even on people who install their own solar system. So it's going to act as like a disincentive for people to go solar, even though like after the hurricane, that's what like literally everyone agreed, you know, that it was ridiculous that Puerto Rico has know, solar, and that essentially, and that that would help make the system more resilient to future severe storms.
Well, that doesn't bode well for solar. The electrical system before the hurricane was powered by filthy imported oil, which was toxic at ground level and extremely damaging to the climate. Is that what's powering the system now that the grid has been more or less restored?
I mean, essentially, they patched back together the system that was already there, and now they're, like, moving towards natural gas, even though there's, like, a very strong renewable energy law on the books now, and there's a lot of talk about moving towards solar. There's also a lot of money moving towards natural gas.
How big a threat is this possible privatization to the grid, to ratepayers, and to solarizing the system?
If you're trying to ambitiously move in the direction of more solar and more rooftop solar in particular, which is what the Puerto Rican government says it wants to do, then this really sets you back because it puts this new charge onto the rates, which, you know, will crowd out new investment. And then similarly, as I just mentioned, it imposes a tax on people who install their own grid-connected solar systems. And so that becomes, you know, a disincentive for people to move in that direction, too.
Does the Congress or other groups in the U.S. have a role to play?
I mean, in terms of the debt deal, first of all, there's been, the deal was only announced a couple of weeks ago, and so I think the, like, opposition is still, like, forming and still going to see, like, who comes out against it and how. But, I mean, so far, Raul Grijalva, who's the chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, which is the most powerful congressional committee in terms of Puerto Rico, he's come out publicly and urged the bankruptcy judge to reject the deal. Nidia Velasquez, who's a representative from New York, who's Puerto Rican, has come out just, I think, today or yesterday against the deal. So there are people in the mainland who are starting to speak up about it as well. And then I think we'll see in the coming weeks how community and labor groups in Puerto Rico start mobilizing against it.
That was Kathy Kunkel of the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. Learn more about opposition to the privatization of Puerto Rico's electric utility by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.